House Blaintree, House Terrick, House Deddings, House Leicester, and House Wayne were set aflame. Then Maegor himself took wing, flying Beleriand to the Westerlands, where he burned the castles of the Brooms, the Folwells, the Lorches, and the other pious lords who had defied his summons. Lastly, he descended upon the seat of House Doggett, reducing it to ash. The fires claimed the lives of Ser Geoffrey's father, mother, and young sister, along with their sworn swords, serving men and chattel. As pillars of smoke rose all through the Westerlands and the Riverlands, Vhagar and Beleriand turned south. Another Lord High Tower, counselled by another High Septon, had opened the gates of Old Town during the conquest. But now it seemed as if the greatest and most populous city in Westeros must surely burn. Thousands fled Old Town that night, streaming from the city gates or taking ship for distant ports. Thousands more took to the streets in drunken revelry. "This is a night for song and sin and drink," men told one another, "for come the morrow the virtuous and the vile burn together." Others gathered in septs and temples and ancient woods to pray they might be spared. In the starry sept, the High Septon railed and thundered, calling down the wrath of the gods upon the Targaryens. The archmaesters of the citadel met in conclave. The men of the city watch filled sacks with sand and pails with water to fight the fires they knew were coming. Along the city walls, crossbows, scorpions, spitfires, and spear throwers were hoisted onto the battlements in hopes of bringing down the dragons when they appeared. Led by Ser Morgan Hightower, a younger brother of the Lord of Old Town, 200 warriors' sons spilled forth from their chapter house to defend his High Holiness, surrounding the starry sept with a ring of steel. Atop the High Tower, the great beacon fire turned a baleful green as Lord Martin Hightower called his banners. Old Town waited for the dawn and the coming of the dragons. And the dragons came. Vhagar first, as the sun was rising, then Beleriand just before midday. But they found the gates of the city open, the battlements unmanned, and the banners of House Targaryen, House Tyrell, and House Hightower flying side by side atop the city walls. The Dowager Queen Visenya was the first to learn the news. Sometime during the blackest hour of that long and dreadful night, the High Septon had died. A man of 53, as tireless as he was fearless, and to all appearances in robust good health, this High Septon had been renowned for his strength. More than once he had preached for a day and a night without taking sleep or nourishment. His sudden death shocked the city and dismayed his followers. Its causes are debated to this day. Some say that his High Holiness took his own life in what was either the act of a craven afraid to face the wrath of King Maegor, or a noble sacrifice to spare the good folk of Old Town from dragonfire. Others claimed the Seven struck him down for the sin of pride, for heresy, treason, and arrogance. Many and more remain certain he was murdered. But by whom? Ser Morgan Hightower did the deed at the command of his lord brother, some say, and Ser Morgan was seen entering and leaving the High Septon's privy chambers that night. Others point to the Lady Patrice Hightower, Lord Martin's maiden aunt and a reputed witch, who did indeed seek an audience with his High Holiness at dusk, though he was alive when she departed. The archmaesters of the citadel are also suspected, though whether they made use of the dark arts, an assassin or a poisoned scroll is still a matter of some debate. Messages went back and forth between the citadel and the starry sept all night. And there are still others, who hold them all blameless and lay the High Septon's death at the door of another rumoured sorceress, the Dowager Queen Visenya Targaryen. The truth will likely never be known, but the swift reaction of Lord Martin when word reached him at the High Tower is beyond dispute. At once he dispatched his own knights to disarm and arrest the warrior's sons, amongst them his own brother. The city gates were opened, and Targaryen banners raised along the walls. Even before Vhagar's wings were sighted, Lord Hightower's men were rousting the most devout from their beds and marching them to the starry sept at spear point to choose a new High Septon. It required but a single ballot. Almost as one, the wise men and women of the faith turned to a certain Septon Pater. 90 years old, blind, stooped and feeble, but famously amiable, the new high Septon almost collapsed beneath the weight of the crystal crown when it was placed upon his head. But when Maegor Targaryen appeared before him in the starry sept, he was only too pleased to bless him as king and anoint his head with holy oils, even if he did forget the words of the blessing. Queen Visenya soon returned to Dragonstone with Vhagar, but King Maegor remained in Old Town for almost half the year, holding court and presiding over trials. To the captive swords of the warrior's sons a choice was given. Those who renounced their allegiance to the Order would be permitted to travel to the Wall and live out their days as brothers of the Night's Watch. Those who refused could die as martyrs to their faith. 3/4 of the captives chose to take the black. The remainder died. 7 of their number, famous knights and the sons of lords, were given the honour of having King Maegor himself remove their heads with blackfire. The rest of the condemned were beheaded by their own former brothers-in-arms. Of all their number, only one man received a full royal pardon, Ser Morgan Hightower. The new High Septon formally dissolved both the warriors' sons and the poor fellows, commanding their remaining members to lay down their arms in the name of the gods. The 7 had no more need of warriors, proclaimed his High Holiness. Henceforth the Iron Throne would protect and defend the faith. King Maegor granted the surviving members of the faith militant till year's end to surrender their weapons and give up their rebellious ways. After that, those who remained defiant would find a bounty on their heads, a gold dragon for the head of any unrepentant warrior's son, a silver stag for the lice-ridden scalp of a poor fellow. The new High Septon did not demur, nor did the most devout. During his time at Old Town, the king was also reconciled with his first wife, Queen Cerise, the sister of his host, Lord Hightower. Her grace agreed to accept the king's other wives, to treat them with respect and honour, and speak no further ill against them, whilst Maegor swore to restore to Cerise all the rights, incomes, and privileges due her as his wedded wife and queen. A great feast was held at the Hightower to celebrate their reconciliation. The revels even included a bedding and a second consummation, so all men would know this to be a true and loving union. How long King Maegor might have lingered at Old Town cannot be known, for in the latter part of 43 AC another challenge to his throne arose. His Grace's long absence from King's Landing had not gone unnoticed by his nephew, and Prince Aegon was quick to seize his chance. Emerging at last from Casterly Rock, Aegon the Uncrowned and his wife Rhaena raced across the riverlands with a handful of companions and entered the city, concealed beneath sacks of corn. With so few followers, Aegon dared not seat himself upon the Iron Throne, for he knew he could not hold it. They were there for Rhaena's Dreamfire, and so the prince might claim his father's dragon, Quicksilver. In this bold endeavour they were aided by friends in Maegor's own court, who had grown weary of the king's cruelties. The prince and princess entered King's Landing in a wagon pulled by mules, but when they made their departure it was on dragonback, flying side by side. From there, Aegon and Rhaena returned to the Westlands to assemble an army. As the Lannisters of Casterly Rock were still reluctant to openly espouse Prince Aegon's cause, his adherents gathered at Pink Maiden Castle, seat of House Piper. John Piper, Lord of Pink Maiden, had pledged his sword to the prince, but it was widely believed that it was his fiery sister Melanie, Rhaena's girlhood friend, who won him to the cause. It was there at Pink Maiden that Aegon Targaryen, mounted on Quicksilver, descended from the sky to denounce his uncle as a tyrant and usurper, and call upon all honest men to rally to his banners. The lords and knights who came were largely Westermen and river lords, the lords Tarbeck, Root, Vance, Charlton, Frey, Page, Perrin, Farman and Westerling were amongst them, together with Lord Corbray of the Vale, the bastard of Barrowton, and the fourth son of the Lord of Griffin's Roost. From Lannisport came 500 men under the banner of a bastard son of Lyman Lannister, Sir Tyler Hill, by which ploy the cunning Lord of Casterly Rock lent supporters to the young prince, whilst still keeping his own hands clean should Maegor prevail. The Piper levies were led not by Lord John or his brothers, but by their sister Melanie, who donned man's mail and took up a spear. 15,000 men had joined the rebellion as Aegon the Uncrowned began his march across the Riverlands to stake his claim to the Iron Throne, led by the prince himself on King Aenys's beloved dragon, Quicksilver. Though their ranks included seasoned commanders and puissant knights, no great lords had rallied to Prince Aegon's court. But Queen Tyana, Mistress of Whisperers, wrote to warn Maegor that Storm's End, the Eyrie, Winterfell, and Casterly Rock had all been in secret communication with his brother's widowed Queen Alyssa. Before declaring for the Prince of Dragonstone, they wished to be convinced he might prevail. Prince Aegon required a victory. Maegor denied him that. From Harrenhal came forth Lord Harroway, from Riverrun, Lord Tully. Sir Davos Darklyn of the King's Guard marshalled 5,000 swords in King's Landing and struck out west to meet the rebels. Up from the Reach came Lord Peake, Lord Merryweather, Lord Caswell, and their levies. Prince Aegon's slow-moving host found armies closing from all sides, each smaller than their own force, but so many that the young prince, still but 17, did not know where to turn. Lord Corbray advised him to engage each foe separately before they could join their powers, but Aegon was loath to divide his strength. Instead, he chose to march on toward King's Landing. Just south of the God's Eye, he found Davos Darklyn's Kingslanders athwart his path, sitting on high ground behind a wall of spears, even as scouts reported Lords Merryweather and Caswell advancing from the south and Lords Tully and Harroway from the north. Prince Aegon commanded a charge, hoping to break through the Kingslanders before the other loyalists fell upon his flanks, and mounted Quicksilver to lead the attack himself. But scarce had he taken wing when he heard shouts and saw his men below pointing to where Beleriand the Black Dread had appeared in the southern sky. King Maegor had come. For the first time since the doom of Valyria, dragon contended with dragon in the sky, even as battle was joined below. Quicksilver, a quarter the size of Beleriand, was no match for the older, fiercer dragon, and her pale white fireballs were engulfed and washed away in great gouts of black flame. Then the Black Dread fell upon her from above, his jaws closing round her neck as he ripped one wing from her body. Screaming and smoking, the young dragon plunged to earth, and Prince Aegon with her. The battle below was nigh as brief, if bloodier. Once Aegon fell, the rebels saw their cause was doomed and ran, discarding arms and armor as they fled. But the loyalist armies were all around them, and there was no escape. By day's end, 2,000 of Aegon's men had died, against 100 of the king's. Amongst the dead were Lord Alan Tarbeck, Dennis Snow, the Bastard of Barrowton, Lord Ronald Vance, Sir William Whistler, Melanie Piper and three of her brothers, and the Prince of Dragonstone, Aegon the Uncrowned of House Targaryen. The only notable loss amongst the loyalists was Sir Davos Darklyn of the Kingsguard, slain at the hands of Lord Corbray with Lady Forlorn. Half a year of trials and executions followed. Queen Visenya persuaded her son to spare some of the rebellious lords, but even those who kept their lives lost lands and titles and were forced to give up hostages. One notable name could be found neither amongst the dead nor the captive. Rhaena Targaryen, sister and wife to Prince Aegon, had not joined the host. Whether that was by his command or her own choice is still debated to this day. All that is known for certain is that Rhaena remained at Pink Maiden Castle with her daughters when Aegon marched, and with her, Dreamfire. Would the addition of a second dragon to the prince's host have made a difference when battle was joined? We shall never know. Though it has been pointed out, and rightly, that Princess Rhaena was no warrior, and Dreamfire was younger and smaller than Quicksilver, and certainly no true threat to Beleriand the Black Dread. When word of the battle reached the west, and Princess Rhaena learned that both her husband and her friend Lady Melanie had fallen, it is said she heard the news in a stony silence. "Will you not weep?" she was asked, to which she replied, I do not have the time for tears. Whereupon, fearing her uncle's wrath, she gathered up her daughters, Eria and Rhaela, and fled farther, first to Lannisport, and then across the sea to Fair Isle, where the new lord, Mark Farman, whose father and elder brother had both perished in the battle, fighting for Prince Aegon, gave her sanctuary and swore no harm would come to her beneath his roof. For the best part of a year the people of Fair Isle watched the east in dread, fearing the sight of Beleriand's dark wings. But Maegor never came. Instead, the victorious king returned to the Red Keep, where he grimly set about getting himself an heir. The 44th year after the conquest was a peaceful one, compared to what had gone before. But the maesters who chronicled those times wrote that the smell of blood and fire still hung heavy in the air. Maegor the First, Targaryen, sat the Iron Throne as his Red Keep rose around him, but his court was grim and cheerless, despite the presence of his three queens. Or perhaps because of it. Each night he summoned one of his wives to his bed, yet, still, he remained childless, with no heir but for the sons and daughters of his brother Aenys. Maegor the Cruel, he was called, and Kinslayer as well, though it was death to say either in his hearing. In Old Town, the ancient High Septon died, and another was raised up in his place. Though he spoke no word against the king or his queens, the enmity between King Maegor and the faith endured. Hundreds of poor fellows had been hunted down and slain, their scalps delivered to the king's men for the bounty, but thousands more still roamed the woods and hedges and the wild places of the Seven Kingdoms, cursing the Targaryens with their every breath. One band even crowned their own High Septon, in the person of a bearded brute named Septon Moon. And a few warriors' sons still endured, led by Sir Geoffrey Doggett, the Red Dog of the Hills. Outlawed and condemned, the Order no longer had the strength to meet the king's men in open battle, so the Red Dog sent them out in the guise of hedge knights, to hunt and slay Targaryen loyalists and traitors to the faith. Their first victim was Sir Morgan Hightower, late of their order, cut down and butchered on the road to Honeyholt. Old Lord Merryweather was the next to die, followed by Lord Peake's son and heir, Davos Darklyn's aged father, even Blind John Hogg. Though the bounty for the head of a warrior's son was a golden dragon, the small folk and peasants of the realm hid and protected them, remembering what they had been. On Dragonstone, the Dowager Queen Visenya had grown thin and haggard, the flesh melting from her bones. Queen Alyssa remained on the island as well, with her son Jaehaerys and her daughter Alysanne, prisoners in all but name. Prince Viserys, the eldest surviving son of Aenys and Alyssa, was summoned to court by his grace. A promising lad of 15 years, beloved of the commons, Viserys was made squire to the king, with a Kingsguard knight for a shadow to keep him well away from plots and treasons. For a brief while in 44 AC, it seemed as if the king might soon have that son he desired so desperately. Queen Alice announced she was with child, and the court rejoiced. Grand Maester Desmond confined her grace to her bed as she grew great with child and took charge of her care, assisted by two septers, a midwife, and the queen's sisters, Jane and Hannah. Maegor insisted that his other wives serve his pregnant queen as well. During the third moon of her confinement, however, Lady Alice began to bleed heavily from the womb and lost the child. When King Maegor came to see the stillbirth, he was horrified to find the boy a monster, with twisted limbs, a huge head, and no eyes. "This cannot be my son," he roared in anguish. Then his grief turned to fury, and he ordered the immediate execution of the midwife and septers who had charge of the queen's care, and Grand Maester Desmond as well, sparing only Alice's sisters. It is said that Maegor was seated on the Iron Throne with the head of the Grand Maester in his hands when Queen Tyana came to tell him he had been deceived. The child was not his seed. Seeing Queen Cerise return to court, old and bitter and childless, Alice Harroway had begun to fear that the same fate awaited her unless she gave the king a son, so she had turned to her lord father, the Hand of the King. On the nights when the king was sharing a bed with Queen Cerise or Queen Tyana, Lucas Harroway sent men to his daughter's bed to get her with child. Magor refused to believe. He told Tyana she was a jealous witch and barren, throwing the Grand Maester's head at her. "Spiders do not lie," the mistress of the Whisperers replied. She handed the king a list. Written there were the names of 20 men alleged to have given their seed to Queen Alice. Old men and young, handsome men and homely ones, knights and squires, lords and servants, even grooms and smiths and singers. The king's hand had cast a wide net, it seemed. The men had only one thing in common. All were men of proven potency, known to have fathered healthy children. Under torture, all but 2 confessed. One, a father of 12, still had the gold paid him by Lord Harroway for his services. The questioning was carried out swiftly and secretly, so Lord Harroway and Queen Alice had no inkling of the king's suspicions until the king's guard burst in on them. Dragged from her bed, Queen Alice saw her sisters killed before her eyes as they tried to protect her. Her father, inspecting the Tower of the Hand, was flung from its roof to smash upon the stones below. Harroway's sons, brothers, and nephews were taken as well. Thrown onto the spikes that lined the dry moat around Magor's holdfast, some took hours to die. The simple-minded Horace Harroway lingered for days. The 20 names on Queen Tyana's list soon joined them, and then another 12 men named by the first 20. The worst death was reserved for Queen Alice herself, who was given over to her sister-wife Tyana for torment. Of her death we will not speak, for some things are best buried and forgotten. Suffice it to say that her dying took the best part of a fortnight, and that Magor himself was present for all of it, a witness to her agony. After her death, the queen's body was cut into 7 parts, and her pieces mounted on spikes above the 7 gates of the city, where they remained until they rotted. King Magor himself departed King's Landing, assembling a strong force of knights and men-at-arms, and marching on Harrenhal to complete the destruction of House Harroway. The great castle on the God's Eye was lightly held, and its castellan, a nephew of Lord Lucas and cousin to the late queen, opened his gates at the king's approach. Surrender did not save him. His grace put the entire garrison to the sword, along with every man, woman, and child he found to have any drop of Harroway blood. Then he marched to Lord Harroway's town on the Trident, and did the same there. In the aftermath of the bloodletting, men began to say that Harrenhal was cursed, for every lordly house to hold it had come to a bad and bloody end. Nonetheless, many ambitious king's men coveted Black Harren's mighty seat with its broad and fertile lands, so many that King Magor grew weary of their entreaties, and decreed that Harrenhal should go to the strongest of them. Thus did 23 knights of the king's household fight with sword and mace and lance amidst the blood-soaked streets of Lord Harroway's town. Sir Walton Towers emerged victorious, and Magor named him Lord of Harrenhal. But the melee had been a savage affray, and Sir Walton did not live long enough to enjoy his lordship, dying of his wounds within the fortnight. Harrenhal passed to his eldest son, though its domains were much diminished as the king granted Lord Harroway's town to Lord Alton Butterwell and the rest of the Harroway holdings to Lord Darnold Darry. When at last Magor returned to King's Landing to seat himself again upon the Iron Throne, he was greeted with news that his mother, Queen Visenya, had died. Moreover, in the confusion that followed the death of the Queen Dowager, Queen Alyssa and her children had made their escape from Dragonstone, with the dragons Vermithor and Silverwing. To where, no man could say. They had even gone so far as to steal Dark Sister as they fled. His Grace ordered his mother's body burned, her bones and ashes interred beside those of the Conqueror. Then he sent his king's guard to seize his squire, Prince Viserys. "Chain him in a black cell and question him sharply," Magor commanded. "Ask him where his mother has gone." "He may not know," protested Sir Owen Bush, a knight of Magor's King's Guard. "Then let him die," the king answered famously. "Perhaps the bitch will turn up for his funeral." Prince Viserys did not know where his mother had gone, not even when Tyana of Pentos plied him with her dark arts. After 9 days of questioning, he died. His body was left out in the ward of the Red Keep for a fortnight at the king's command. "Let his mother come and claim him," Maegor said. But Queen Alyssa never appeared, and at last his grace consigned his nephew to the fire. The prince was 15 years old when he was killed, and had been much loved by small folk and lords alike. The realm wept for him. In 45 AC, construction finally came to an end on the Red Keep. King Maegor celebrated its completion by feasting the builders and workmen who had labored on the castle, sending them wagon loads of strong wine and sweetmeats, and whores from the city's finest brothels. The revels lasted for 3 days. Afterward, the king's knights moved in and put all the workmen to the sword, to prevent them from ever revealing the Red Keep's secrets. Their bones were interred beneath the castle that they had built. Not long after the completion of the castle, Queen Cerise was stricken with a sudden illness and passed away. A rumour went around the court that her grace had given offence to the king with a shrewish remark, so he had commanded Sir Owen to remove her tongue. As the tale went, the queen had struggled. Sir Owen's knife had slipped, and the queen's throat had been slit. Though never proven, this story was widely believed at the time. Today, however, most maesters believe it to be a slander concocted by the king's enemies to further blacken his repute. Whatever the truth, the death of his first wife left Maegor with but a single queen, the black-haired, black-hearted Pentoshi woman Tyana, mistress of the spiders, who was hated and feared by all. Hardly had the last stone been set on the Red Keep when Maegor commanded that the ruins of the Sept of Remembrance be cleared from the top of Rhaenys's Hill, and with them the bones and ashes of the warriors' sons who had perished there. In their place, he decreed, a great stone stable for dragons would be erected, a lair worthy of Beleriand, Vhagar, and their Geat. Thus commenced the building of the Dragon Pit. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it proved difficult to find builders, stonemasons, and labourers to work on the project. So many men ran off that the king was finally forced to use prisoners from the city's dungeons as his workforce, under the supervision of builders brought in from Myr and Volantis. Late in the year 45 AC, King Maegor took the field once again to continue his war against the outlawed remnants of the Faith Militant, leaving Queen Tyana to rule King's Landing together with the new hand, Lord Edwell Celtigar. In the great wood south of the Blackwater, the king's forces hunted down scores of poor fellows who had taken refuge there, sending many to the wall and hanging those who refused to take the black. Their leader, the woman known as Poxy Jane Poor, continued to elude the king until at last she was betrayed by 3 of her own followers, who received pardons and knighthoods as their reward. 3 septons, travelling with his grace, declared Poxy Jane a witch, and Maegor ordered her to be burned alive in a field beside the Wendwater. When the day appointed for her execution came, 300 of her followers, poor fellows and peasants all, burst from the woods to rescue her. The king had anticipated this, however, and his men were ready for the attack. The rescuers were surrounded and slaughtered. Amongst the last to die was their leader, who proved to be Sir Horace Hill, the bastard hedge knight who had escaped the carnage at the Great Fork 3 years earlier. This time he proved less fortunate. Elsewhere in the realm, however, the tide of the times had begun to turn against the king. Small folk and lords alike had come to despise him for his many cruelties, and many began to give help and comfort to his enemies. Septon Moon, the High Septon, raised up by the poor fellows against the man in Old Town they called the High Lickspittle, roamed the riverlands and reach at will, drawing huge crowds whenever he emerged from the woods to preach against the king. The hill country north of the Golden Tooth was ruled in all but name by the Red Dog, Sir Geoffrey Doggett, self-proclaimed Grand Captain of the Warriors' Sons. Neither Casterly Rock nor River Run seemed inclined to move against him. Dennis the Lame and Ragged Silas remained at large, and wherever they roamed, small folk helped keep them safe. Knights and men-at-arms sent out to bring them to justice oft vanished. In 46 AC, King Maegor returned to the Red Keep with 2,000 skulls, the fruits of a year of campaigning. They were the heads of poor fellows and warriors' sons, he announced, as he dumped them out beneath the Iron Throne. But it was widely believed that many of the grisly trophies belonged to simple crofters, field hands, and swineherds, guilty of no crime but faith. The coming of the new year found Maegor still without a son, not even a bastard who might be legitimized. Nor did it seem likely that Queen Tyana would give him the heir that he desired. Whilst she continued to serve his grace as Mistress of Whisperers, the king no longer sought her bed. It was past time for him to take a new wife, Maegor's counselors agreed, but they parted ways on who that wife should be. Grand Maester Benefer suggested a match with the proud and lovely Lady of Starfall, Clarice Dane, in the hopes of detaching her lands and house from Dawn. Alton Butterwell, Master of Coin, offered his widowed sister, a stout woman with 7 children. Though admittedly no beauty, he argued, her fertility had been proved beyond a doubt. The king's hand, Lord Celtica, had 2 young maiden daughters, 13 and 12 years of age respectively. He urged the king to take his pick of them, or marry both, if he preferred. Lord Valerian of Driftmark advised Maegor to send for his niece Rhaena, the widow of Aegon the Uncrowned. By taking her to wife, Maegor could unite their claims, prevent any fresh rebellions from gathering around her, and acquire a hostage against any plots her mother, Queen Alyssa, might foment. King Maegor listened to each man in turn, though in the end he scorned most of the women they put forward. Some of their reasons and arguments took root in him. He would have a woman of proven fertility, he decided, though not Butterwell's fat and homely sister. He would take more than one wife, as Lord Celtigar urged. 2 wives would double his chances of getting a son. 3 wives would triple it. And one of those wives should surely be his niece. There was wisdom in Lord Valerian's counsel. Queen Alyssa and her 2 youngest children remained in hiding. It was thought that they had fled across the narrow sea to Tyrosh, or perhaps Volantis, but they still represented a threat to Maegor's crown and any son he might father. Taking Aenys's daughter to wife would weaken any claims put forward by her younger siblings. After the death of her husband and her flight to Fair Isle, Rhaena Targaryen had acted quickly to protect her daughters. If Prince Aegon had truly been the king, by law his eldest daughter, Arya, stood his heir, and might therefore claim to be the rightful queen of the 7 kingdoms. But Arya and her sister Rhaela were barely a year old, and Rhaena knew that to trumpet such claims would be tantamount to condemning them to death. Instead, she dyed their hair, changed their names, and sent them from her, entrusting them to certain powerful allies who would see them fostered in good homes by worthy men who would have no inkling of their true identities. Even their mother must not know where the girls were going, the princess insisted. What she did not know, she could not reveal, even under torture. No such escape was possible for Rhaena Targaryen herself. Though she could change her name, dye her hair, and garb herself in a tavern wench's rough spun or the robes of a scepter, there was no disguising her dragon. Dreamfire was a slender, pale-blue she-dragon with silvery markings who had already produced 2 clutches of eggs, and Rhaena had been riding her since the age of 12. Dragons are not easily hidden. Instead, the princess took them both as far from Maegor as she could, to Fair Isle, where Mark Farman granted her the hospitality of Fair Castle, with its tall white towers rising high above the sunset sea. And there she rested, reading, praying, wondering how long she would be given before her uncle sent for her. Rhaena never doubted that he would, she said afterward. It was a question of when, not if. The summons came sooner than she would have liked, though not as soon as she might have feared. There was no question of defiance. That would only bring the king down on Fair Isle with Balerion. Rhaena had grown fond of Lord Farman, and more than fond of his 2nd son, Andro. She would not repay their kindness with fire and blood. She mounted Dreamfire and flew to the Red Keep, where she learned that she must marry her uncle, her husband's killer. And there as well Rhaena met her fellow bride, for this was to be a triple wedding. Lady Jane of House Westerling had been married to Alan Tarbeck, who had died with Prince Aegon in the battle beneath the God's Eye. A few months later she had given her late lord a posthumous son. Tall and slender, with lustrous brown hair, Lady Jane was being courted by a younger son of the Lord of Casterly Rock when Maegor sent for her, but this meant little and less to the king. More troubling was the case of Lady Eleanor of House Costaigne, the wife of Sir Theo Bolling, a landed knight who had fought for the king in his last campaign against the poor fellows. Though only 19, Lady Eleanor had already given Bolling 3 sons when the king's eye fell upon her. The youngest boy was still at her breast when Sir Theo was arrested by the king's guard and charged with conspiring with Queen Alyssa to murder the king and place the boy Jaehaerys on the Iron Throne. Though Bolling protested his innocence, he was found guilty and beheaded the same day. King Maegor gave his widow 7 days to mourn in honour of the gods, then summoned her to tell her they would marry. At the town of Stony Sept, Septon Moon denounced King Maegor's wedding plans, and hundreds of townfolk cheered wildly, but few others dared to raise their voices against his grace. The High Septon took ship at Oldtown, sailing to King's Landing to perform the marriage rites. On a warm spring day in the 47th year after the conquest, Maegor Targaryen took 3 wives in the ward of the Red Keep. Though each of his new queens was garbed and cloaked in the colours of her father's house, the people of King's Landing called them the Black Brides, for all were widows. The presence of Lady Jane's son and Lady Eleanor's 3 boys at the wedding ensured that they would play their parts in the ceremony, but there were many who expected some show of defiance from Princess Rhaena. Such hopes were quelled when Queen Tyana appeared, escorting 2 young girls with silver hair and purple eyes, clad in the red and black of House Targaryen. "You were foolish to think you could hide them from me," Tyana told the princess. Rhaena bowed her head and spoke her vows in a voice as cold as ice. Many queer and contradictory stories are told of the night that followed, and with the passage of so many years it is difficult to separate truth from legends. Did the 3 black brides share a single bed, as some claim? It seems unlikely. Did His Grace visit all 3 women during the night and consummate all 3 unions? Perhaps. Did Princess Rhaena attempt to kill the king with a dagger concealed beneath her pillows, as she later claimed? Did Eleanor Costaigne scratch the king's back to bloody ribbons as they coupled? Did Jane Westerling drink the fertility potion that Queen Tyana supposedly brought her, or throw it in the older woman's face? Was such a potion ever mixed or offered? The first account of it does not appear until well into the reign of King Jaehaerys, 20 years after both women were dead. This we know. In the aftermath of the wedding, Maegor declared Rhaena's daughter Arya, his lawful heir, until such time as the gods grant me a son, whilst sending her twin, Rhaela, to Oldtown to be raised as a scepter. His nephew, Jaehaerys, the rightful heir by all the laws of the 7 kingdoms, was expressly disinherited in the same decree. Queen Jane's son was confirmed as Lord of Tarbeck Hall and sent to Casterly Rock to be raised as a ward of Lyman Lannister. Queen Eleanor's elder boys were similarly disposed of, one to the Eyrie, one to Highgarden. The queen's youngest babe was turned over to a wet nurse, as the king found the queen's nursing irksome. Half a year later, Edwell Celtigar, the king's hand, announced that Queen Jane was with child. Hardly had her belly begun to swell when the king himself revealed that Queen Eleanor was also pregnant. Maegor showered both women with gifts and honours, and granted new lands and offices to their fathers, brothers, and uncles, but his joy proved to be short-lived. 3 moons before she was due, Queen Jane was brought to bed by a sudden onset of labour pains, and was delivered of a stillborn child as monstrous as the one Alice Harroway had birthed, a legless and armless creature possessed of both male and female genitalia. Nor did the mother long survive the child. Maegor was cursed, men said. He had slain his nephew, made war against the faith and the High Septon, defied the gods, committed murder and incest, adultery and rape. His privy parts were poisoned, his seed full of worms. The gods would never grant him a living son. Or so the whispers ran. Magor himself settled on a different explanation and sent Sir Owen Bush and Sir Maladon Moore to seize Queen Tyana and deliver her to the dungeons. There the Pentoshi Queen made a full confession, even as the king's torturers readied their implements. She had poisoned Jane Westling's child in the womb, just as she had Alice Haraway's. It would be the same with Eleanor Costain's whelp, she promised. It is said that the king slew her himself, cutting out her heart with blackfire and feeding it to his dogs. But even in death Tyana of the Tower had her revenge, for it came to pass just as she had promised. The moon turned and turned again, and in the black of night Queen Eleanor, too, was delivered of a malformed and stillborn child, an eyeless boy born with rudimentary wings. That was in the 48th year after the conquest, the 6th year of King Magor's reign and the last year of his life. No man in the Seven Kingdoms could doubt that the king was accursed. Now, what followers still remained to him began to melt away, evaporating like dew in the morning sun. Word reached King's Landing that Sir Geoffrey Doggett had been seen entering Riverrun, not as a captive, but as a guest of Lord Tully. Septon Moon appeared once more, leading thousands of the faithful on a march across the Reach to Oldtown, with the announced intent of bearding the lickspittle in the Starry Sept to demand that he denounce the abomination on the Iron Throne and lift his ban on the military orders. When Lord Oakheart and Lord Rowan appeared before him with their levies, they came not to attack Moon, but to join him. Lord Celtigar resigned as King's Hand and returned to his seat on Claw Isle. Reports from the Dornish marches suggested that the Dornish men were gathering in the passes, preparing to invade the realm. The worst blow came from Storm's End. There on the shores of Shipbreaker Bay, Lord Rogar Baratheon proclaimed young Jaehaerys Targaryen to be the true and lawful king of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Men, and Prince Jaehaerys named Lord Rogar Protector of the Realm and Hand of the King. The prince's mother, Queen Alyssa, and his sister Alysanne stood beside him as Jaehaerys unsheathed Dark Sister and vowed to end the reign of his usurping uncle. 100 banner lords and Stormland knights cheered the proclamation. Prince Jaehaerys was 14 years old when he claimed the throne, a handsome youth, skilled with lance and longbow, and a gifted rider. More, he rode a great bronze and tan beast called Vermithor, and his sister Alysanne, a maid of 12, commanded her own dragon, Silverwing. "Magor has only one dragon," Lord Rogar told the Stormlords. "Our prince has two." And soon, three. When word reached the Red Keep that Jaehaerys was gathering his forces at Storm's End, Rhaenyra Targaryen mounted Dreamfire and flew to join him, abandoning the uncle she had been forced to wed. She took her daughter Arya and Blackfyre, stolen from the king's own scabbard as he slept. King Maegor's response was sluggish and confused. He commanded the Grand Maester to send forth his ravens, summoning all his leal lords and bannermen to gather at King's Landing, only to find that Bennifer had taken ship for Pentos. Finding Princess Arya gone, he sent a rider to Oldtown to demand the head of her twin sister Rayla to punish their mother for her betrayal, but Lord Hightower imprisoned his messenger instead. Two of his Kingsguard vanished one night to go over to Jaehaerys, and Sir Owen Bush was found dead outside a brothel, his member stuffed into his mouth. Lord Valerian of Driftmark was amongst the first to declare for Jaehaerys. As the Valerians were the realm's traditional admirals, Magor woke to find he had lost the entire royal fleet. The Tyrells of Highgarden followed, with all the power of the Reach. The High Towers of Oldtown, the Red Wines of the Arbor, the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, the Arryns of the Eyrie, the Royces of Runestone. One by one, they came out against the king. In King's Landing, a score of lesser lords gathered at Magor's command, amongst them Lord Darklyn of Duskendale, Lord Massey of Stonedance, Lord Towers of Harrenhal, Lord Staunton of Rook's Rest, Lord Bar Emmon of Sharp Point, Lord Buckwell of the Antlers, the Lords Rosby, Stokeworth, Hayford, Hart, Birch, Rollingford, Bywater, and Mallory. Yet they commanded scarce 4,000 men amongst them all, and only 1 in 10 of those were knights. Magor brought them together in the Red Keep one night to discuss his plan of battle. When they saw how few they were, and realized that no great lords were coming to join them, many lost heart, and Lord Hayford went so far as to urge his grace to abdicate and take the black. His grace ordered Hayford beheaded on the spot, and continued the war council with his lordship's head mounted on a lance behind the Iron Throne. All day the lords made plans, and late into the night. It was the hour of the wolf when at last Magor allowed them to take their leave. The king remained behind, brooding on the Iron Throne as they departed. Lord Towers and Lord Rosby were the last to see his grace. Hours later, as dawn was breaking, the last of Magor's queens came seeking after him. Queen Eleanor found him still upon the Iron Throne, pale and dead, his robes soaked through with blood. His arms had been slashed open from wrist to elbow on jagged barbs, and another blade had gone through his neck to emerge beneath his chin. Many to this day believe it was the Iron Throne itself that killed him. Magor was alive when Rosby and Towers left the throne room, they argue, and the guards at the doors swore that no one entered afterward, until Queen Eleanor made her discovery. Some say it was the Queen herself who forced him down onto those barbs and blades to avenge the murder of her first husband. The King's Guard might have done the deed, though that would have required them to act in concert, as there were two knights posted at each door. It might also have been a person or persons unknown, entering and leaving the throne room through some hidden passage. The Red Keep has its secrets, known only to the dead. It might also be that the king tasted despair in the dark watches of the night, and took his own life, twisting the blades as needed and opening his veins to spare himself the defeat and disgrace that surely awaited him. The reign of King Magor the First Targaryen, known to history and legend as Magor the Cruel, lasted 6 years and 66 days. Upon his death, his corpse was burned in the yard of the Red Keep, his ashes interred afterward on Dragonstone beside those of his mother. He died childless, and left no heir of his body. Prince into King. The Ascension of Jaehaerys the First. Jaehaerys the First Targaryen ascended the Iron Throne in 48 AC, at the age of 14, and would rule the Seven Kingdoms for the next 55 years, until his death of natural causes in 103 AC. In the later years of his reign, and during the reign of his successor, he was called the Old King, for obvious reasons, but Jaehaerys was a young and vigorous man for far longer than he was an aged and feeble one, and more thoughtful scholars speak of him reverently as the Conciliator. Archmaester Umbert, writing a century later, famously declared that Aegon the Dragon and his sisters conquered the Seven Kingdoms, six of them at least, but it was Jaehaerys the Conciliator who truly made them one. His was no easy task, for his immediate predecessors had undone much of what the Conqueror had built. Aenys through weakness and indecision, Magor with his bloodlust and cruelty. The realm that Jaehaerys inherited was impoverished, war-torn, lawless, and riven with division and mistrust, whilst the new king himself was a green boy with no experience of rule. Even his claim to the Iron Throne was not wholly beyond question. Although Jaehaerys was the only surviving son of King Aenys I, his older brother Aegon had claimed the kingship before him. Aegon the Uncrowned had died at the battle beneath the God's Eye, whilst trying to unseat his uncle Magor, but not before taking to wife his sister Rhaena, and siring two daughters, the twins Arya and Rhaela. If Magor the Cruel were accounted only a usurper, with no right to rule, as certain maesters argued, then Prince Aegon had been the true king, and the succession by rights should pass to his elder daughter, Arya, not his younger brother. The sex of the twins weighed against them, however, as did their age. The girls were but 6 at Magor's death. Furthermore, accounts left us by contemporaries suggest that Princess Arya was a timid child when young, much given to tears and bedwetting, whilst Rhaela, the bolder and more robust of the pair, was a novice serving at the Starry Sept and promised to the faith. Neither seemed to have the makings of a queen. Their own mother, Queen Rhaena, conceded as much when she agreed that the crown should go to her brother Jaehaerys, rather than her daughters. Some suggested that Rhaena herself might have the strongest claim to the crown, as the first-born child of King Aenys and Queen Alyssa. There were even some who whispered that it was Queen Rhaena who had somehow contrived to free the realm from Maegor the Cruel, though by what means she might have arranged his death after fleeing King's Landing on her dragon Dreamfire has never been successfully established. Her sex told against her, however. "This is not Dawn," Lord Rhaegar Baratheon said when the notion was put to him, "and Rhaena is not Nymeria." Moreover, the twice-widowed queen had come to loathe King's Landing and the court, and wished only to return to Fair Isle, where she had found a measure of peace before her uncle had made her one of his black brides. Prince Jaehaerys was still a year and a half shy of manhood when he first ascended the Iron Throne. Thus it was determined that his mother, the Dowager Queen Alyssa, would act as regent for him, whilst Lord Rhaegar served as his hand and the protector of the realm. Let it not be thought, however, that Jaehaerys was merely a figurehead. Right from the first, the boy king insisted upon having a voice in all decisions made in his name. Even as the mortal remains of Maegor the First Targaryen were consigned to a funeral pyre, his young successor faced his first crucial decision: how to deal with his uncle's remaining supporters. By the time Maegor was found dead upon the Iron Throne, most of the great houses of the realm and many lesser lords had abandoned him. But most is not all. Many of those whose lands and castles were near King's Landing and the Crown Lands had stood with Maegor until the very hour of his death, amongst them the Lords Rosby and Towers, the last men to see the king alive. Others who had rallied to his banners included the Lords Stokeworth, Massey, Hart, Bywater, Darklyn, Rollingford, Mallory, Bar Emmon, Birch, Staunton, and Buckwell. In the chaos that had followed the discovery of Maegor's body, Lord Rosby drank a cup of hemlock to join his king in death. Buckwell and Rollingford took ship for Pentos, whilst most of the others fled to their own castles and strongholds. Only Darklyn and Staunton had the courage to remain with Lord Towers to yield up the Red Keep when Prince Jaehaerys and his sisters Rhaena and Alysanne descended upon the castle on their dragons. The court chronicles tell us that as the young prince slid from the back of Vermithor, these three leal lords bent their knees before him to lay their swords at his feet, hailing him as king. "You come late to the feast," Prince Jaehaerys reportedly told them, though in a mild tone, "and these same blades helped slay my brother Aegon beneath the god's eye." At his command, the three were immediately put in chains, though some of the prince's party called for them to be executed on the spot. In the black cells they were soon joined by the king's justice, the Lord Confessor, the Chief Jailer, the Commander of the City Watch, and the four knights of the King's Guard who had remained beside King Maegor. A fortnight later, Lord Rhaegar Baratheon and Queen Alyssa arrived at King's Landing with their host, and hundreds more were seized and imprisoned. Be they knights, squires, stewards, septons, or serving men, the charge against them was the same. They were accused of having aided and abetted Maegor Targaryen in usurping the Iron Throne, and in all the crimes, cruelties, and misrule that followed. Not even women were exempt. Those ladies of noble birth who had attended the Black Brides were arrested as well, together with a score of low-born trulls named as Maegor's Whores. With the dungeons of the Red Keep full to bursting, the question arose as to what should be done with the prisoners. If Maegor were to be counted as usurper, then his entire reign was unlawful, and those who had supported him were guilty of treason and must needs be put to death. Such was the course urged by Queen Alyssa. The Dowager Queen had lost two sons to Maegor's cruelty, and was of no mind to grant the men who had carried out his edicts even the dignity of a trial. "When my boy Viserys was tortured and slain, these men stood by silently and spoke no word of protest," she said. "Why should we listen to them now?" Against her fury stood Lord Rhaegar Baratheon, hand of the king and protector of the realm. Whilst his lordship agreed that Maegor's men were surely deserving of punishment, He pointed out that should their captives be executed, the usurper's remaining loyalists would be disinclined to bend the knee. Lord Rogar would have no choice but to march on their castles one by one, and winkle each man out of his stronghold with steel and fire. "It can be done, but at what cost?" he asked. "It would be a bloody business, one that might harden hearts against us." "Let Magor's men stand trial and confess their treason," the Protector urged. "Those found guilty of the worst crimes could be put to death. For the remainder, let them tender hostages to ensure their future loyalty and surrender some of their lands and castles." The wisdom of Lord Rogar's approach was plain to most of the young king's other supporters, yet his views might not have prevailed had not Jaehaerys himself taken a hand. Though only 10 and 4, the boy king proved from the first that he would not be content to sit by meekly whilst others ruled in his name. With his maester, his sister Alysanne, and a handful of young knights by his side, Jaehaerys climbed the Iron Throne and summoned his lords to attend him. "There will be no trials, no torture, and no executions," he announced to them. "The realm must see that I am not my uncle. I shall not begin my reign by bathing in blood. Some came to my banners early, some late. Let the rest come now." Jaehaerys, as yet, had neither been crowned nor anointed, and was still shy of his majority. His pronouncement, therefore, had no legal force, nor did he have the authority to overrule his council and regent. Yet such was the power of his words, and the determination he displayed as he sat looking down upon them all from the Iron Throne, that Lords Baratheon and Valyrian at once gave the prince their support, and the rest soon followed. Only his sister Rhaena dared say him nay. "They will cheer you as the crown is placed upon your head," she said, "as once they cheered our uncle, and before him our father." In the end, the question rested with the regent, and whilst Queen Alyssa desired vengeance for her own sake, she was loath to go against her son's wishes. "It would make him seem weak," she is reported to have said to Lord Rogar, "and he must never seem weak. That was his father's downfall." And thus it was that most of Magor's men were spared. In the days that followed, the dungeons of King's Landing were emptied. After being given food and drink and clean raiment, the captives were escorted to the throne room, 7 at a time. There, before the eyes of gods and men, they renounced their allegiance to Magor and did homage to his nephew Jaehaerys from their knees, whereupon the young king bade each man rise, granted him pardon, and restored his lands and titles. It must not be thought that the accused escaped without punishment, however. Lords and knights alike were compelled to send a son to court to serve the king and stand as hostages. From those who had no sons, a daughter was required. The wealthiest of Magor's lords surrendered certain lands as well, Towers, Darklyn, and Staunton amongst them. Others purchased their pardons with gold. The royal clemency did not extend to all. Magor's headsmen, jailers, and confessors were all adjudged to be guilty of abetting Tyana of the Tower in the torture and death of Prince Viserys, who had so briefly been Magor's heir and hostage. Their heads were delivered to Queen Alyssa, together with the hands they had dared raise against the blood of the dragon. Her grace pronounced herself well pleased with the tokens. One other man also lost his head, Sir Maradon Moore, a Kingsguard knight who was accused of having held Cerise Hightower, Magor's first queen, whilst his sworn brother, Sir Owen Bush, removed her tongue, during which her grace's struggles caused the blade to slip, bringing about her death. Sir Maradon, it should be noted, insisted the whole tale was a fabrication, and said Queen Cerise died of shrewishness. He did, however, admit to delivering Tyana of the Tower to King Magor's hands and standing witness as he slew her, so he had a queen's blood on his hands regardless. 5 of Magor's 7 yet survived. 2 of those, Sir Oliver Bracken and Sir Raymond Mallory, had played a part in the late king's fall by turning their cloaks and going over to Jaehaerys, but the boy king observed rightly that in doing so they had broken their vows to defend the king's life with their own. "I will have no oath-breakers at my court," he proclaimed. All five Kingsguard were therefore sentenced to death, but at the urging of Princess Alysanne, it was agreed that they might be spared if they would exchange their white cloaks for black by joining the Night's Watch. Four of the five accepted this clemency and departed for the wall, along with Sir Oliver and Sir